Shylock goes home, goes to his house. Lancelot Gobbo, the comic figure, who's the servant to Shylock, has a moral dilemma. And out of the old medieval morality play, there's a good angel and a fiend, and he's debating. And the good angel is telling him, you've got to stay with your master, the Jew. And the fiend is saying, no, run away and serve the Christian. This is backwards. But of course, Lancelot Gobbo is the comic character. He's got everything inverted. Later in the play, he's going to impregnate a serving woman. Okay. His moral compass is askew. But we have the sense of moral choice, moral decision. And he eventually does go with Bassanio. Why? Because he's just got to get out of that house. We meet Jessica, and she's speaking to Lancelot, and her first lines, the first time we meet her, I am sorry thou wilt leave my father so. Our house is hell. And thou, a merry devil, didst rob it of some taste of tediousness. Our house is hell. Strong comment. But indeed, what we could say and how the audience would have taken it quite clearly is, the house is hell because God is not there. It's a place of punishment. It is a place of punishment. And we see she's striving to escape. She wants to get out of there. An audience would understand it. It's classic. It's the oppressive father. It's the young daughter she wants to get. But there's more than that going on in that the vision of the house we get from her, and then we get it from Shylock once he gets home. And he hears that there are going to be masks. There's going to be revelry in the streets, and he won't have it. He's got to go out to dine with those Christians, and he doesn't like it. But while he's gone, Act 2, Scene 5, I'm at line 28. What? Are there masks? Hear you me, Jessica. Lock up my doors. And when you hear the drum and the vile squealing of the wry-necked fife, clamber not you up to the casements then, nor thrust your head into the public street to gaze on Christian fools with varnished faces. But stop my house's ears. I mean my casements. Let not the sound of shallow foppery enter my sober house. No music can come into that house. That house is sober. Jessica has said, this house is hell. And judgment is passed on that in Act 5, pretty clearly, the counter speech from Lorenzo, when they're back at Belmont, and Jessica feels a little melancholy when she hears the music play, and she says, I'm never merry when I hear sweet music. He says, there's a reason for that. Music can affect you deeply. And he gives a number of examples and then says, the man that hath no music in himself, nor is not moved with concord of sweet sounds, is fit for treason, stratagems, and spoils. The motions of his spirit are dull as night, and his affections dark as Erebus. Let no such man be trusted. It's a description of Shylock and his whole house, and not letting music into the house so even his young daughter can hear it. And he's not to be trusted. He is indeed fit for treason, stratagems, and spoils. He's laid a trap to kill Antonio. He's hoping to kill Antonio. It is a stratagem. It is a stratagem. There's no doubt about it. Point being, the house is deadly. She wants out of there. Lancelot Gobbo wants out of there. It may be a house filled with money, but that's not enough. That's not enough. By the way, let me make another point. This just occurs to me. I'll toss it in here. Shylock appears in 5 of the 20 scenes in this play. To claim that he's the dominant character, I mean, just in terms of percentage of stage time, he's not around that much. It is about equivalent with what we find in Malvolio and Jaques. It's somewhat more than Don John. So again, he's not on stage that much. He is driving the plot, and he's central to it, but he does not get that much stage time. Another way of preempting, what I'm calling preempting, any possible sympathy we could have for the man. He admits what he's going to do before he does it. in Act 1. In Act 2, we learn what his house is like before we see him enter it. And it is a house of money. It's a house of gold. And we know where that leads. The gold casket tells us. I spoke about that last night. Then Jessica escapes. And she does steal from her father. She steals gold. She takes the casket of ducats. It's theft. The audience in Shakespeare's time would have sympathized with her. On an objective level, she is stealing. It is problematic. Shakespeare is not writing a morality play. We're in the same, Antonio should not spit on Shylock. Jessica steals from her father. These are not perfect characters. These are human characters. But they're moving towards something better at the end. We learn about it before, and we learn about his reaction before we see it. Solanio tells us, he reports it. I never heard a passion so confused, so strange, outrageous, and so variable as the dog Jew did utter in the streets. My daughter, oh my ducats, oh my daughter, fled with the Christian, oh my Christian ducats, justice, the law, my ducats and my daughters. On and on. Then we see him. So we've already heard it. It's preempted. It's not presented directly. That is, we're one remove from it when we see it. What does this do? It removes a measure of sympathy. When we do see him next, it is again with Solanio and Salerio. And he's enraged. He's enraged. He says his daughter is damned for going off. He says that she's made a bad match. He says, I made a bad match. Now Antonio's a bankrupt. I won't get my money back, but let him look to his bond. Salerio, why, I'm sure if he forfeit, thou wilt not take his flesh. What's that good for? Wait a minute, you're not seriously going to go through with that. What's his flesh good for? And here comes the great speech, the one that is always pointed to. As Shakespeare showing sympathy for Shylock, there is a measure of truth in it. Let me read the speech and then we'll go through it. What's that good for? What's his flesh good for? To bait fish withal. If it will feed nothing else, it will feed my revenge. He hath disgraced me and hindered me 500,000, laughed at my losses, mocked at my gains, scorned my nation, thwarted my bargains, cooled my friends, heated mine enemies, and what's his reason? I am a Jew. Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is? If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? If we are like you in the rest, we will resemble you in that. If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility? Revenge. If a Christian wrong a Jew, what should his sufferance be by Christian example? Why, revenge. The villainy you teach me I will execute, and it shall go hard, but I will better the instruction. It's a magnificent speech. It is rounding the character. It gives him a human dimension, but look at the speech, okay? Why does Shylock want revenge? One, he's disgraced me. Publicly in the streets, probably. Hindered me 500,000. He cost me money. Laughed at my losses. When I lost money, he mocked me because I lost money. Mocked at my gains. I made money and he laughed at me because I shouldn't have made money that way. What's this all about? Money, 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 money. And then, scorn my nation. It comes about sixth on the list. Thwarted my bargains. Cooled my friends. Heated mine enemies. All of that in terms of friends and enemies, again, has to do with money. Very clearly. What's his reason? I'm a Jew. And here we go. The core of the speech, that he is human as everyone else is, but please notice the list he gives. Eyes, hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with food, hurt with weapons, subject to diseases, healed by the same means, warmed. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do you not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? It's all physical, except with the possible affections and passions. It is all physical. It's all earthly. It is a fair argument. We are creatures of the earth as you are. We are made the way you are made. It's a fair argument. But what we have again, that the play is moving toward, is a higher spiritual vision. Who chooses me must give and hazard all he hath. What Shylock is obsessed with is things of the earth. His own body, his own nature, his own gold. And even in the defense of himself, he is thinking that same way. And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? You have wronged, he wronged me, I'm getting back at him. If we are like you in the rest, we shall resemble you in that. If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility? Revenge. Well, I have no doubt that Christians will strike back in revenge when wronged. But they are not being Christian in doing it. Very clear mandate from our Lord. You turn the other cheek. So that what we have there is the equivalent of the Catholic saying, well, yes, I'm a Catholic, and I only use birth control some of the time. Look, we're in a problem area. No, for it's supposed to be forgiveness. To be a Christian is to forgive. Shylock is saying, uh-uh. I wrong a Christian, the Christian gets revenge on me. If a Christian wrong a Jew, what should his sufferance be by Christian example? No, excuse me, it's by Old Testament teaching. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Strike back. We're fudging the ideas here. Why revenge? Okay, I'll strike back because that's what you taught me to do. The villainy you teach me I will execute and it shall go hard, but I will better the... And I'll hit you back twice as hard. And you get the escalation of violence. Read tomorrow's paper. I don't know what happened today, but it'll be in tomorrow's paper. Striking back, you know, and so many dead, and this many killed, and that many more killed, okay? It's the notion, striking back, revenging. That should not be, by any means, something that the Christians taught him. If they did, they did it because they weren't being Christian. But again, what we have there is something in the way of an excuse. And what we don't have is the notion again of giving and hazarding. Let's take a chance and not revenge. They leave, in comes Tubal. What news from Genoa? Hast thou found my daughter? This is Shylock's friend. We get now a different vision of friendship. Antonio and Bassanio, the friends. Shylock and Tubal, the friends. I often came where I did hear of her, but cannot find her. While there. A diamond gone cost me 2,000 ducats in Frankfurt. The curse never fell upon our nation till now. I never felt it till now. I'm cursed. My daughter's run, she took the diamond and 2,000 ducats. Is it gone or didn't she get enough for it? 2,000 ducats in that and other precious, precious jewels. I would my daughter were dead at my foot and the jewels in her ear. The gold casket, who chooseth me shall get what every man desires. If you desire gold, what do you get? Death. I would my daughter were dead at my feet as long as I got my money back. But mind you, modern reading, this is the tragic hero of the play. Would she were hearsed at my feet and the ducats in her coffin. And there we literally have a casket filled with gold. No news of them, why so? And I know not what spent in the search. Why thou loss upon loss? The thief gone with so much and so much to find the thief. I'm spending money now trying to find her. There's more money gone. There's very little consideration of Jessica. Yes, other men have ill luck too. Antonio, as I heard in Genoa, what? Ill luck? Hath an argosy cast away coming from Tripolis. I thank God, is it true? I spoke with some of the sailors that escaped the rack. I thank thee, good Tubal. Good news. Ha ha. Heard in Genoa. A moment of joy in his friend. His friend says, your daughter spent in Genoa, as I heard, one night, 40 ducats. We're toying. Couldn't find your daughter. She's spending money like crazy. Oh, no, but Antonio's lost. Hooray. But your daughter spent a lot of your money. This is a friend? Thou stickest a dagger in me, he says. I shall never see my gold again. 40 ducats at a sitting? 40 ducats? There came divers of Antonio's creditors in my company to Venice that swear he cannot choose but break. Let's spin him again. Whoosh! This is a friend? I am very glad of it. I'll plague him. I'll torture him. I am glad of it. One of them showed me a ring that he had of your daughter for a monkey. I'm not kidding. This is one of the most vicious scenes in Shakespeare. This is Tubal, Shylock's one good friend we meet. God spare us such friends. But what are we finding out? Jessica's being frivolous. I suspect she doesn't really need the monkey. Jessica's being a young woman. I've got lots of money. Oh, look at the cute monkey. I think I'll buy it. A ring he had out upon her. Thou torturest me, Tubal. It was my turquoise. I had it of Leo when I was a bachelor. I would not have given it for a wilderness of monkeys. He loved his wife. He wouldn't have given that ring up for a wilderness of monkeys because his wife gave it. And suddenly, fully human. A creature capable of love. It's just a masterstroke on Shakespeare's part. And what does he use for it? I would never give that ring away. What are we setting up? The Act 4 beginning of the ring plot, where Bassanio gives the ring away. Why does Bassanio give the ring away? Out of friendship, giving and hazarding. Why did Shylock cling to the ring? It came from his wife. But again, I wouldn't have given it for a wilderness of monkeys. I wouldn't care how many monkeys I got. 2,000 monkeys, 3,000 monkeys. What are we still thinking in? Worldly terms, as he expresses what must have been a real love. Incredible moment. That's what makes Shakespeare a genius. We have a moment of real humanity. But Antonio is certainly undone. Whack! One last slap by Tubal. Nay, that's true. That's very true. Go, Tubal. Fee me an officer. Bespeak him a fortnight before. I will have the heart of him if he forfeit. For were he out of Venice, I can make what merchandise I will. And boom. That glimpse of humanity was only a glimpse. I'll cut his heart out, and once he's gone, I can really make some good money here. Go, Tubal, and meet me at our synagogue. Go, good Tubal, at our synagogue, Tubal. I'm sorry, this is not a heroic figure. This may be a human figure. This is not a heroic figure. And the failing of Shylock, the obsession with the earthly, with the monetary, with making money, is precisely what the play is teaching against, is saying there, no, wrong view, and therefore he is the antagonist. He is the antagonist. Now, there really is not a need to go through the great scene. It's very clear. Because what happens there is, indeed, he's insisting on the bond. I made the point last night. He is demanding justice. That's what he gets. The point being, he gets, shall we say, justice with interest. He gets more back than he bargained for. There's another irony. He wanted justice according to his own terms, but justice will always return something more. Justice will give something more back, and that's what he gets. That's what he gets. Before it happens, when Portia speaks to him, first, she asks the question, cannot Antonio discharge the money? Yes, Bassanio says, here, I offer it twice the sum. If that will not suffice, I will be bound to pay it 10 times over, on forfeit of my hands, my head, my heart. If this will not suffice, says Bassanio, it must appear that malice bears down truth. If he won't take back 10 times the amount and my hands, my head, and my heart, then we're not dealing with truth here or justice, we're dealing with malice. And I beseech you, rest once the law to do your authority, to do a great right, do a little wrong, and curb this cruel devil of his will. It must not be. There is no power in Venice can alter a decree established. Okay? 'Twill be recorded for a precedent, and many an error by the same example will rush into the state. It cannot be. We cannot dispense with the law. The law is there. She's already made the plea for mercy. That was rejected. The money's been rejected. Shylock, there's thrice the money. An oath, I have an oath in heaven. It is about malice. And the fact that getting the heart out of Antonio means unlimited profits. And a chance to strike back. You spat on me, I'll rip your heart out. Literally. We get the law, okay? Prepare your bosom for the knife. Here we go. And then, of course, he gets justice. I got to make this point. It's simply the case. In the sources, and Shakespeare, there are no original plots in Shakespeare, as you know. He took from old stories and legends. So the bond plot appears other places. The combining it with the casket plot is his invention. The bond plot is elsewhere. The major source, an Italian play, Il Pecorone. But there are other sources. In none of the earlier pound of flesh stories, which obviously were the models, is such a heavy punishment meted out. What Shakespeare adds to the story is the weight of punishment according to the law. He loses his fortune, he is sentenced to death, and he is forced to convert, which again is beyond anything that really was allowed by either Rome or the government again, church or state. You could not force someone to convert. But please notice what's going on here. Shylock is operating out of a principle that was also denied by church and government. He has been the spokesman for usury, so forget what the church says and what governments say. Well, there's a sense it happens when they force him to convert. How do we view it? Shakespeare very clearly knew what would happen at that moment. His audience would have been cheering. How do we view it? That's an interesting question. That is a fascinating question. But it is not paused on. And what we have is Shylock agrees to the conditions because he has no choice. He has received justice. But when they take away his wealth, nay, take my life and all, pardon not that, you take my house when you do take the prop that doth sustain my house. What's the prop that has sustained his house? His money. You take my life when you do take the means whereby I live. You'll kill me if you take away my money. If that's the case, then you've been living for the wrong thing. Your house could not stand anyway. You have not laid up treasure in the proper place. He is aware it's over for him in that sense. Art thou contented, Jew? What dost thou say? Asks Portia. He says, I am content. Clark, draw a deed of gift. I pray you give me leave to go from hence. I am not well. Send the deed after me, and I will sign it. And he exits. That's it. We don't hear of him again in the play. There has been a restoration of order through justice. It is painful. You better believe that when the judgment comes, a lot of people are going to find it painful. But the fact of the matter is, Shylock chose to prop his house that way. He chose to live that way. He chose usury. He chose to go after Antonio. He chose to put together the bond that way, and he chose to pursue it right till the final moment. And if he is desolate, the simple fact of the matter is it's something we know very well and Shakespeare knew very well. Man has free will. It is all of those creatures, again, all of those souls in Dante's Inferno, and the point Dante makes over and over and over and over again. God does not send that soul to hell. The soul chooses hell. Because the soul had free choice. Shylock is now desolate. But this has not been dumped on him accidentally by a group of mean-spirited people. He demanded justice. He got it. He got the full justice of the law. He chose that. He chose desolation. And that's the end of the Shylock story as far as Shakespeare is concerned. But what has happened over the years? We have four kinds of stage Shylocks. In theater history, we've got four kinds of stage Shylocks. Number one, a comic villain. And one can be villain and still get some comedy. And he's got some comic lines. Olivier did that quite well. There's some good comic lines there. In Othello, Iago is an unspeakable villain. He's got some great comic lines. There comes a point, however, where the comic villain isn't funny anymore. And it's very clear in this play it happens when Shylock goes after Antonio's heart. So in a sense, and this has to come out of the original vision of the play, we have a comic villain who is frightening. He's the antagonist. He's a real threat to the happiness in the play. But finally, he's dispensed with. He goes away. He is a source of wickedness like the wicked stepmother. Suddenly, he just melts and vanishes. He's the wicked witch of the West. You know, you throw the water on him and he's gone because there's nothing there to sustain him. And then the rest of the film, then we get back to Oz. We get the broomstick, we get back to Oz. The evil's gone. The threat is gone. Shylock's gone. And we get the rest of the play. Then some actors saw an opportunity and switched that, and he became a titanic, diabolic figure. Grand evil. Not comic villain, but some sort of, a really overpowering and frightening villain. Dark, ominous, there from the beginning, clear in his intention. To do that is to overlook the comedy that's in the role and some of the humanity that's in the role. How do you give the line about the ring? Leah gave it to me. If you're just an overwhelming, grand, diabolical villain, won't work. Then what do we get? Out of that comes, and this is Olivier's, the tragic figure. The tragic figure. We've got a hero brought low who is wronged. He probably made a mistake in pursuing the bond, but oh, the punishment he receives. Let me say one thing. An important part of tragedy always, and especially Shakespearean tragedy, is when the tragic hero falls, he gains in wisdom. The fall in Shakespearean tragedy is always for the good of the hero. He may suffer, he may go through agony, we may feel pity and terror, but that figure is learning. Shylock does not seem to have learned anything here. So that if he is a tragic figure, it's breaking the Shakespearean pattern. There's not another play in which he does it. Or, of course, finally now, and this is where we come to, a composite of all of these, and some scenes, one thing another. What is forgotten is his role in the play. His role as a figure, a common figure in Shakespearean comedy, the outsider. And he ends up as the outsider. He's by himself, alone. He is cast out. He is gone. We can't have that now. It's not allowed. It's just not permitted. Why? Because we can no longer speak critically of any Jew. Let me read something that showed up on one of the papers I got on The Merchant of Venice. And this, I pulled this off. Quote, this comes from a first-class midshipman. Jessica does not think of going back to forgive Shylock. This is a flaw in Jessica that all Christians alike possess. Christians all believe that they are the most virtuous. They are the first to point the finger when others are at fault. This makes them hypocrites because they try to justify their actions, making them no better than anyone else. And there you've got those damn Christians. Imagine the same young man writing something similar on a paper about the Jews or blacks or women. He'd be in jail now for committing a hate crime. But this they can say without fear of contradiction. He got contradicted on that, by the way. This they can say without fear of contradiction because it's open season on Christians. We can bash them all we want. And the other reason, sadly, this is probably the last time in my life I'll get to teach this play because I can't go into the classroom and teach it, is the moment you start talking about Christian virtue or Christian values, every eyeball in the classroom rolls back in its head, except for the fundamentalists who start salivating and jump up and down and hope that there's a Bible around so they can start thumping it. Walker Percy is right. These words are drained of meaning. They no longer signify. You say Christian and forget it. I don't want to hear that, please. Oh, that stuff again? Ugh. It's on the radio, it's the guys on TV, I grew up with it, I've heard all that, they're hypocrites, oh, just forget it. You say Jew, and every eye pops open. What's he going to say? As Walker Percy says, it's the in his novel The Thanatos Syndrome, Jew is the last word that signifies, that carries meaning. You say Jew, and people start hitting each other and fighting and rolling on the ground. And Percy says, why is this? He has a wonderful essay where he says, why are these people still here? Where are the Hittites? This grand, glorious, they're all gone. Where are the Hittites? And this rag of these nomads are still around, and they're still signifying to that with that intensity. What's going on here? Does their story still carry such intense meaning that they can cause such heated diversity of opinion and fights and outrages? And absolutely. Absolutely they can. Because it's clear, what do we know? They still have a part to play in the ongoing story. And right now, the part they have to play is that they have suffered. They went through a Holocaust. They had to sacrifice themselves. And who was it that did it? Who's responsible? It's those Christians. So don't you talk to me about sacrifice and suffering and offering yourself up. We're the ones that did it. And we're not going to let you forget it. And we have a substitution very clearly. And you know who's being shoved out of the picture. Christ is gone. Don't you mention him. And don't you dare suggest we had any part to play in that. There is no history. History began about 40 years ago. 40, 50 years ago. That's when it started. That's what we're looking at. That's all we're looking at. And therefore, we'll even rewrite history. I don't care that many of my brethren of the time, says the Jew, praised Pius XII for what he did to assist many Jews to survive. Uh-uh. That's not part of the current plan. He was responsible. He's the one who should have been in there and done something. He should have spoken up. He let it happen. Says the voice that says the church has no role in politics. Catholics should stay out of politics, except once one pope at one moment in history was fully responsible for everything that happened. Excuse me, you're being illogical. Don't you tell me that, I've suffered. Now, at the time, when many countries, the English among them, had expelled the Jews, gone from Spain, they weren't in France, the fact of the matter is the safest place for them to be, there were a number in Italy. As one of the commentators on the play says, a wonderful, sensible man named Edgar Stoll, he taught at the University of Minnesota. It's an essay written in 1911. It's got some common sense in it. But he simply says if the safest place to be would be living somewhere near the Pope in Rome, who would protect them. Who would protect them. As did Pius XII. As will any real Christian, should real violence break out again, for all the criticism, and I am being critical, the reason that the Catholic must be the best friend that the Jews have is the Catholic looks at the Jew and says, a soul to be saved. And as a Catholic, that must be my primary concern. And I have an obligation, because when I look on a suffering brother, I cannot see that kind of individuality. I have a primary duty. However, if we have that individual or many individuals trying to shove Christ out of the picture as king of society, king of the world, king of the universe, then I will stand up and protest. And I will do it openly and loudly, and I will criticize. When I see the joyous, delightful, happy comic ending of a beautiful Christian comedy corrupted and turned into a misrepresentation that claims it is a play about the suffering of a Jewish hero, I'll say, no, that's a lie. But it is part of a pattern of shoving Christ out of the picture. There cannot be a happy ending. There cannot be Christian joy as long as there is suffering for the Jew. And I will say, we have a situation where that misery will continue until you convert. And your primary duty is to convert. And I'll sit down and explain why to you if you want to listen. Because that again is my duty. And what do we know? There is a moment in time coming when a large number will convert. It's going to happen at some point. It's one reason they're still here. How does it fit into God's plan? We don't know exactly. That's part of His providential plan. But my first obligation is to Christ and to proclaim His kingship. But part of my obligation as a believer in Christ is to love my brother, and that's all my fellow men. And so, I will protect, preserve, criticize, try to convert, and love. And if I'm spat on for it, I will try to be patient and not spit back, because I'm human and can often not behave as well as a Christian should. But when I do that, then I go to confession, because it's a spiritual problem. It's a spiritual problem. And when I see all around me a world that is becoming obsessed with money, gold, finances, business, getting ahead, trapping people and destroying individuals and families by outrageous interest rates on homes, on credit cards, on cars, then I have an obligation to say, no, there's something very wrong here. And the first thing that's wrong is this has nothing to do with the purpose why any of us should be on this earth. We're here to know, love, and serve God in this world and be with Him in the next. And that's my home. That's primary. And if you get what every man desires, you're going to end up with nothing. And if you get what you think you deserve, you're going to end up in a place you don't want to be. But if you give and hazard all you have, there is a chance that given God's mercy, you'll make a good end. Let me give the last word to a great Catholic writer, Father Fahy. This is from the Kingship of Christ and the Conversion of the Jewish Nation. As Abraham merited by his faith and obedience to be the ancestor of the head of redeemed humanity, who was therefore of Jewish blood, so we by our faith and obedience are his spiritual descendants, spiritually Semites, members of the mystical body of his seed. This is what Pope Pius XI emphasized when he used the expression, anti-Semitism is inadmissible. We are spiritually Semites. Pope Pius XI's phrase is an echo of the one used by Pope Pius IX to the Jewish convert priests, the Fathers Lehman. You are the sons of Abraham, and I also. The phrase used by Pope Pius XI has been very frequently quoted, in fact, so frequently that one is inclined to suspect that it is being used as propaganda with a view to emphasizing one aspect of the question, especially when one hardly ever finds any allusion to the previous portion of the Pope's discourse. Pope Pius XI had also said, quote, it is impossible for Christians to be anti-Semites, but we acknowledge that everyone has the right to defend himself. In other words, to take the necessary precautions for his protection against everything that threatens his legitimate interests. Thus we find in this pronouncement of Pope Pius XI the two currents which down the centuries run through the official declarations of the Holy See concerning the Jews. On the one hand, the sovereign pontiff strives to protect the Jews from physical violence and to secure respect for their family life and their worship as the life and worship of human persons. On the other hand, they aim unceasingly at protecting Christians from the contamination of Jewish naturalism and try to prevent Jews from obtaining control over Christians. The existence of the second needs to be strongly stressed because to some extent it has been lost sight of in recent times. Catholics need to be made familiar not only with the repeated papal condemnations of the Talmud, but with the measures taken by the sovereign pontiffs to preserve society from the inroads of Jewish naturalism. Otherwise, They will be exposed to the risk of speaking as Pope St. Pius V and Pope Benedict XIV, for example, as anti-Semites and showing their ignorance of the meaning of supernatural life and of the rule of Christ the King over society. We recently had a prince of the church, Cardinal Bernardin, who stated that the Gospel of John was anti-Semitic. It's gone further now than just accusing certain pontiffs. It's now to the point of actually accusing one of the evangelists. This is loose. This is out there. Father Fahey speaks absolute firm sense, and what we must emphasize first and foremost, at our peril if necessary, is that there is a supernatural life which calls us, and Christ is the King over all society. Thank you. A couple minutes for questions, yes.
Is there any case for Portia snubbing Jessica during the cold shoulder?
It's in the film. It's in the film. There is, in the play, there isn't much of a connection until Act 5. I think what's treated as a comic moment that then grows in the play a bit, or in that vision of that version of the play, is put in because by the time Jessica arrives, Portia is preoccupied. But I think that was a slight exaggeration, but it's the least I could live with that. I could live with that. That does not in any way have to do necessarily to do with Jessica being Jewish. One woman's quite capable of snubbing another for all sorts of reasons. But then turning around and being very warm and gracious in the next instant. It's the mystery of the heart of woman. Yes?
I can see now, after your talk, why you had to see this film.
Yes.
Is there one that corresponds better to?
Sadly, there isn't, to be quite honest. There's a BBC production done just after this one. The Shylock's much better. I think it's a better performance than Olivier's. He has some real menace in him. He's very frightening. He's got some humanity in him, which I think is balanced. But the Portia is strident and pert, and you want to slap her half the time. The strength of this version is that I think the Portia is lovely, very feminine, and quite delightful. I have seen some good productions on stage. It still occasionally gets done. One thing I should mention, there is another exaggeration turning up occasionally. I've seen it a couple of times. That is, there's something funny in Antonio's concern for Bassanio. Mm-hmm. And so at the end, we're in Belmont, and his ships come in, and he's got the letters, and then all the couples go off to bed, and the last to go is Portia and Bassanio, and Antonio looks at Bassanio going off to bed with Portia, and drops the letters, "What does money mean when I've lost my love?" It's just grotesque. Absolutely grotesque. But what is fascinating, of course, and what they have no idea they're doing, that's the other violation of nature, that Dante sticks in the same circle. Boom, it pops up again at the same time. That's not accidental. But what you have again is it suddenly now becomes the tragedy of Antonio, the merchant of Venice who gave his heart to a young man and was spurned and cast off at the... It's just, who can stand it? Who can stand it? But what is in this play that the modern world can't deal with? Christ and heterosexual love. So we gotta muck with that. We can't leave that there. It's much too healthy. We've evolved beyond all that. Yeah.
Sorry, the scene with Shylock in the boardroom. Mm-hmm. They're asking why he wants to pursue this bond, and he says, "It's just my humor."
It's just my humor.
Just humor me. I mean, he
Some can't stand a cat. Some can't stand a gaping pig. Oh, it's a phony excuse. He's already told us why he's pursuing the bomb. We know. No, this is the public. Butter won't melt in my mouth. Okay. It's my whim. It's my whim. It's written down here. I want justice. Why not? Why not? You don't like this. He doesn't like that. Some people don't like ice cream. I don't like Antonio. I want to cut his heart out. It's whim. It simply doesn't hold up. Doesn't hold up. But again, what it is, a false public face masking real hatred, genuine hatred deep inside.
When you taught this to your students in Annapolis, did you show them a production, one of these productions?
I did not.
This response they're giving is completely of themselves.
It is of themselves because they are good little dogs trained by Pavlov, and you say Christ and they go rawr, rawr, rawr. You say Christian, they go okay, and you say feminist and they go okay, and you say blacks and they go oh, and you say Jews and they weep. No, I mean the reactions are emotional, not intellectual, and they are programmed. They are positively programmed. And sadly, I can no longer use this play to try to break them out of that programmed mold. This is the one I've been using almost constantly now, is Much Ado About Nothing. There's a film of it that I like that is useful. But what it does is it gets to the man-woman question directly, and you can then bring a lot of other things in at the same time. That I can still use. Twelfth Night's a little difficult because, you know, again, we got a lot of Bible beaters at the academy, and they all sympathize with Malvolio. I mean, there's nobody should be having any fun, you know. What's wrong with this? You get from them some of the reaction about Shylock as well. This guy's terribly treated. He's upright. He's good. They shouldn't be up drinking at two. Drinking? What are they doing drinking? You know, singing at 2 a.m. It's just absolutely forbidden. They're very sympathetic to him. And As You Like It is just beautiful. And they're all young cynics and pretend to agree with Jacques anyway. They now, if they fall in love, do it in private and don't let anybody know. Because all they do is mock each other. It's a young generation of Jacques, all cynical about love. It's very sad. It's tough to teach the comedies now because that comic vision is not part of our world anymore. Sadly. Sadly.
This concludes the last conference. Thank you for listening.